Ireland provided a rich recruitment ground for the British overseas services in the latter half of the long 19th century, with the result that by 1919, Irishmen were to be found working as colonial servants in every corner of Britain's dependent empire. Recent research has exploded the notion that Irish nationalism and British imperialism were, by their definitions, dichotomous. Nonetheless, a great majority of Irish colonial servants recruited during this period was drawn from what the Colonial Office termed Ireland's loyalist class, Protestants and so-called Castle Catholics who supported Ireland's constitutional status quo. This paper, which takes as its subject loyalists recruited into the British colonial services during the Irish Revolution and its aftermath, has a twofold focus. First, it assesses the impact of the Irish Revolution on their decisions to enlist, arguing that British imperial service provided a convenient route out of Ireland for loyalists unwilling or unable to remake their lives under the new dispensation in Dublin. Secondly, it examines these recruits' loyalist credentials, arguing that while a majority were born loyalists, others became loyalists by conviction during the period in question or had loyalty thrust upon them by circumstance. The recruitment of Irishmen by the British colonial services began in earnest in the mid-1850s, when Ireland's elite education infrastructure began exploiting the opportunity provided by the introduction of recruitment by competitive examination for the Indian Civil and Medical Services. The appointment of an old boy to the Indian Civil Service quickly became a prize coveted by Ireland's expanding network of fee-paying intermediate colleges, while Irish universities, which were of necessity more vocational in character than their British counterparts, reoriented their curricula to cover the subjects examined. These educational institutions also played a pivotal role in contemporaneous Irish recruitment to the British colonial service. Colleges such as Portora Royal in Enniskillen, St Columba's in Dublin and Clongowes Wood in Kildare, and universities such as Trinity College, the Queen's Colleges and even the Catholic University of Ireland fostered to varying degrees a pro-empire outlook and cultivated an ethos of imperial service. The centrality of Ireland's elite education infrastructure to British colonial services recruitment meant that Irish appointees were overwhelmingly drawn from the demographics that could afford it, namely the Irish Protestant ascendancy and the Catholic upper middle classes. Over 80% of Irish Indian civil servants recruited during Ireland's pre-independence period was drawn from the country's Protestant middle classes, as were 75% of Irish recruits to the colonial service. But Ireland's aspirant Catholic middle classes joined the colonial services in steadily increasing numbers during this period, accounting by the First World War's outbreak for almost 30% of Irish Indian civil service enlistments and 26% of Irish recruits to the colonial service. And some notable exceptions notwithstanding, the majority was, the evidence suggests, supportive of the British-Irish constitutional connection and instinctively loyal to the Crown. Irish interest in Indian civil service recruitment was virtually destroyed by what Scott Cook has described as, quote, the twin jolts of the First World War and the Irish political upheaval that followed, end quote. However, the events of 1919-22 did not adversely impact on Irish recruitment into the colonial service. In fact, the Irish Revolution and its immediate aftermath saw a threefold increase in Irish enlistments to the colonial service's graduate grades, in sectors such as administration, law, medicine, education and engineering. While some, particularly doctors, joined the colonial service for economic reasons during this time, this increase in Irish enlistments was comprised largely of loyalists who used imperial service to escape an emergent Ireland from which they felt politically or otherwise alienated. Some of those who joined, such as Henry Blackhall from Limerick, had nothing but disdain for Irish independence. A Trinity College gold medalist who joined the colonial legal service in 1920, he was, in his own words, quote, although Roman Catholic, a unionist by tradition and conviction, and he refused to become a citizen of the Irish Free State. Others, such as Edward Lumley from Tullamore, accepted an administrative post in Tanganyika in 1923 to escape, quote, the political environment of fanaticism and strife in which I had spent my college years in Dublin, end quote. He felt that, quote, in Africa, at least there would be peace, end quote. Yet others felt that they had no future in the fledgling Free State. For example, Michael O'Connor, who joined the Malayan Medical Service in the mid-1920s, believed that his status as a British ex-serviceman had made him persona non grata in an Ireland that, quote, was still licking her wounds after the grim regime of the Black and Tans and the Civil War that followed, end quote. The Irish Revolution also saw an unprecedented influx of Irish personnel into the colonial police services, the great majority of them disbanded members of the RIC. Although a handful, most notably the former Inspector General Joseph Byrne, secured colonial employment as favours, most were seeking temporary or permanent respite from an Ireland they felt was inveterately hostile towards them on account of their wartime roles. By the time preliminary instructions for the RIC's disbandment were issued in January 1922, swathes of the force were in genuine fear for their personal safety, fears compounded in March by the circulation in certain parts of the country of general proclamations warning RIC personnel not to return to their homes and the issuance of expulsion orders to individual policemen. By June, Andy Cope in Dublin Castle was complaining to Michael Collins of, quote, a concerted movement for a wholesale expulsion, end quote, of RIC personnel and or their families, which he claimed was rapidly extending from the southern counties to Carlow, Meath, Dublin, Cavan and East Galway. Subsequent events suggest that reports of the level of danger faced by former policemen during this time was overblown. However, there was sufficient incidence of actual attacks, some 40 of which culminated in murder, to convince ex-RIC that their lives were in peril. These killings induced a real sense of panic among disbanding policemen, and at least 2,000 fled Ireland in fear of their lives or in despair of securing a livelihood. Approximately 300 of these joined the colonial police services, most notably the British section of the Palestine Gendarmerie, which was established in spring 1922. 3 years after Irish independence, the colonial services' de facto director of recruitment, Ray Furze, could tell his officials that, quote, the majority of the best candidates from the Irish Free State who have come to us have mainly done so because they wish to escape from being under its government, end quote. Files recently released as part of the controversial Hanslope disclosure lay bare the manner in which the Colonial Office dealt with Indigenous Crown servants in Cyprus during and after the British withdrawal. Compensation was paid to about 100 such men whose prospects British officials believed would be fatally compromised under the new Cyprus Republic, while those believed to be in particular danger on account of their actions during the years of the EOCA insurgency were exfiltrated to the UK. As in Ireland, those most exposed were the police, who in the words of the island's British intelligence chief had, quote, displayed a tenacity of purpose and a loyalty far surpassing that which they could in any circumstances, but particularly in those of Cyprus, be expected of any police officer, end quote. By summer 1960, approximately 100 Cypriots who, as one colonial office put it, had, quote, stuck out their necks on our behalf during the emergency, end quote, had been exfiltrated to London for safety, many with their families in tow. Yet more made their own way without British assistance, and by December 1960, an estimated 500 Cypriots had relocated to Britain because of imminent threats to their lives. The Colonial Office's approach to the Irish Loyalist predicament was less immediate and muscular, but it did on occasion actively facilitate Irish Loyalist flight. For example, a number of Irish lawyers joined the Colonial Legal Service in 1921-22 after the Irish Chief Secretary, Sir Hamer Greenwood, successfully petitioned the Colonial Secretary, Alfred Milner, to consider members of the Irish Bar for appointments overseas. These gentlemen, Greenwood pleaded, quote, have had a bad time and will have a worse time owing to the cessation of much of the work of the courts in Ireland. They have loyally refused to touch the Sinn Féin courts and they suffer for it, end quote. Subsequently, Milner's successor, Winston Churchill, conceived the idea of sending disbanded RIC men to the police to police the recently acquired Palestine Mandate, in part in the hope that, quote, the Holy Land would afford these men shelter from the danger they were facing at home, end quote. The Colonial Office's sense of the danger being faced by Crown servants was compounded by the targeting by Irish Republican elements of colonial officials either retired to or on home leave in Ireland during this time. This began on Bloody Sunday, November 1920, with a raid on the Dublin lodgings of Dr. Norman Parsons Jewell of the East Africa Medical Service by what he described in his memoir as, quote, a group of men looking for me to kill me, end quote. Jewell escaped harm, having moved out of his lodgings 3 days earlier to begin his return journey to Kenya. But Colonial Police Service cadet John Joseph Fitzgerald was not so fortunate. He was, as was the norm, serving in the RIC, to gain practical policing experience pending his first posting overseas when he was shot at 28 Earlsford Terrace just 2 weeks prior to his set date for sailing. In March 1921, masked men attempted to torch the home of a retired colonial administrative officer in North Kerry, while 1 year later, an administrative officer on home leave from Nigeria, Michael Garvey, was given 24 hours to clear out of Ireland or pay the price. Both Jewell and Garvey believed that their receipt of mail bearing the official British government franc had made them marked men by identifying them as colonial servants and placing them under suspicion of being spies. In consequence, the Crown agents for the colonies instructed in May 1922 that plain stamped envelopes be used for all correspondence to addresses in Ireland, and the Colonial Office followed suit in September, albeit only in cases where expressly requested by a correspondent to do so. For while its principal officer, John Flood, described the fears of Irish colonial services in this regard as, quote, amply justified, end quote, he felt that it was, quote, only in the wilds that there is much risk, and even then the most that is likely to happen would be a notice to clear out at once, end quote. However, Flood cautioned that the colonial secretary Winston Churchill's controversial engagement with Ireland posed what he described as an additional element of danger, even in more settled areas like Dublin, adding that if he himself, and he was an Irishman and a staunch loyalist, had, quote, been captured by irregulars, I am pretty sure that my colonial office pass would have proved a pass to the next world, end quote. Such were Colonial Office concerns in this regard that while its Under-Secretary Sir John Shuckburgh termed this rather humiliating subterfuge of posting mail in plain envelopes was still in place in the mid-1940s. Republican attacks on Irish colonial servants derived from a belief that they were by definition loyalists. In his self-described anatomy of loyalism in late colonial Kenya, Bethwell Allen Ogot identified, quote, several types of loyalist, each with differing motivations, end quote, and the same may be said of Palestinian Arabs who assisted Britain in crushing the Great Revolt of the 1930s. The available evidence on the loyalism of Irish colonial servants also reveals allegiances more complex than Irish Republicans supposed. Most were certainly loyalist by birth, men who genuinely supported the British-Irish constitutional connection and the wider British imperial project. 65% was Protestant, at a time when Irish Protestantism was largely, though clearly not entirely, synonymous with loyalism. Many came from families with strong traditions of Crown and imperial service in the civilian and or military spheres, or had family involvement in unionist politics. Some subsequently joined loyalist organisations themselves, such as the Irish Loyalist Imperial Federation, which was founded in the mid-1930s. Moreover, a majority of the Catholics then recruited came from demonstrably loyalist stock, the sons of successful professionals and merchants and middle to high-ranking civil servants who saw the British-Irish connection as underpinning their continued prosperity. For example, Henry and Edward Burke Gaffney, who joined the Colonial Medical Service and the Malayan Public Works Department respectively during this period, were the sons of the retired Chief Valuer at the Valuation Office in Dublin, while the father of Colonial Medical Officer Charles Blake Jennings was an RIC County Inspector. Similarly, with the self-styled unionist by tradition and conviction, Henry Blackall. He was, he maintained, from Anglo-Irish stock on both sides. His father descended from, quote, a Cromwellian adventurer who had a grant of lands in County Limerick, end quote, while his mother's family, he said, belonged to the Irish peerage. Others came from families with strong traditions of British military service in both domestic and imperial theatres. However, some Irish colonial servants born outside of the unionist tradition, became loyalists during the revolutionary period itself. Bethwell Ogot has noted the part played by Mau Mau atrocities in Kenya, such as the Lari massacre of March 1953, in provoking ordinary Kikuyu to loyalism. And some Irish colonial servants, one would assume a small number, followed a similar trajectory. Erstwhile home rulers, they were appalled by the brutality of the IRA onslaught and decried the political success of Sinn Féin, which they saw as a fatally retrograde step. Martin Mahoney was typical of these. A self-declared former Redmondite who served as an officer with the King's African Rifles before joining the Colonial Administrative Service in Kenya, His post-1919 sympathies were, quote, all with Ulster for valuing her civilisation and working to stay out, end quote, and he developed a violent hatred of Irish Republicans. Noting what he termed more quibbling from Ireland in spring 1922, he confided to his diary his hope that, quote, please goodness it will be war, and this time I hope they, that is the British, exterminate the whole brood of Sinn Féiners, men, women and children, for who honour, truth and playing the game are not only unknown, but absolutely foreign to their natures, end quote. He relished the increasing prospect of an Irish nationalist civil war, which he believed would make a British reconquest inevitable. RIC Constable Robert Holmes, who joined the British section of the Palestine Gendarmerie in March 1922, also developed loyalist political convictions. He was shocked by the violence of the IRA campaign, and he saw the victory of what he termed Republican ruffians as a national disaster. By summer 1922, he was so despairing of the situation in Ireland that he declared, quote, become pro-British, end quote. He returned to Ireland post-Palestine only to marry and relocated to Birmingham, England. Similarly with RIC District Inspector Michael McConnell, who was another British gendarmerie recruit and a future Deputy Inspector General of the Palestine Police. Quote, the war, that is the War of Independence, made a Britisher of me. I wanted no truck with Ireland for years after that, end quote. However, most RIC personnel who opted for imperial service in 1922-23 had loyalty thrust upon them by circumstance. Andrew Novo has noticed the difficulties faced by Greek Cypriot members of the Cyprus police force during the years of the EOKA insurgency in, quote, being asked to oppose a cause to which many were inherently sympathetic and casting themselves as collaborators in the process, end quote. And similarly with Catholic RIC, the majority of who was generally accepted were probably Home Rulers, and although they did not approve of the way that the Irish Free State was founded, they had, as the son of one RIC sergeant put it, quote, no ambivalence in their loyalty to the new state or any residual loyalties to the ancient regime, end quote. This lack of ideological loyalism among ex-RIC was implicitly acknowledged by the Southern Irish Loyalist Relief Association, which referred to its constituency as, quote, loyalist and the RIC, end quote. Nonetheless, RIC were dealt with like loyalists, and many were forced out of Ireland in consequence, as I've noted. The personal testimonies of those who transferred to the Palestine Mandate make clear the frustrations to which their branding as loyalists gave rise. Their views encapsulated by one ex-RIC constable from Wexford, who wrote his mother in May 1922, quote, I am a good Irishman, whatever Mr. De Valera might say, end quote. He had left Ireland on the day of disbandment due to Republican threats, including pressure from his brothers who were IRA members. Some Irish recruits to the Colonial Service's graduate grades also felt forcibly draped in the Loyalist mantle, this despite their indifference or opposition to the Loyalist cause. For example, Administrative Officer Edward Lumley, who was a lower-class Methodist without political convictions and who was supportive of the Irish Free State, felt that his status as a Trinity College student cast him as a loyalist in IRA eyes. Quote, we were all regarded as adherents of the British enemy, and more than one of our alumni had been murdered, end quote. He left for Tanganyika as soon as the opportunity arose. And similarly with Michael O'Connor, who, while Irish nationalist in outlook, felt labelled as loyalist due to his British military service. He went to Malaya following his discovery that he had been, albeit in error, quote, diagnosed as an agent of Dublin Castle during the troubled period, end quote, and slated for what he termed liquidation. The use of the colonial services as a route out of Ireland by disaffected loyalists ceased in the mid-1920s, but members of Ireland's loyalist class continued to enlist in disproportionate numbers, and despite the gradual expansion of the socio-political and religious base from which Irish colonial service candidates was drawn, this remained the case until the colonial office was closed in the mid-1960s. Indeed, loyalist credentials became an essential criterion in Southern Irish recruitment during this time. Drawing on what Barry Crosby describes as, quote, British sensitivities to perceived threats to the British Empire coming from within the imperial bureaucratic edifice itself, end quote, and in this case, it would be a threat from Irish Republicans, efforts were made to, as the Deputy Director of Recruitment, Francis Newbold, put it, quote, probe into the antecedent loyalty of each individual Irish case, end quote. so as to preclude the infiltration of those he variously described as Irish Quislings and Wrong'uns. As late as the 1950s, Irish candidates were tested through interview for what was termed right-mindedness, which was the requisite pro-British worldview to serve faithfully the Crown and its imperial interests. The majority of Southern Irish loyalists lived out their lives peaceably in the New Ireland, but what was, by any reckoning, a non-negligible minority clearly suffered enforced or involuntary self-imposed exile. Irish colonial servants constituted a minority of this minority, and an assessment of the extent to which research findings on their attitudes and experience have wider application requires a great deal of further research. But at the very least, their stories shed further light on Irish loyalist flight and the human costs it involved. Thank you.